Our next speaker is not the same one as on the flyer. If you saw the flyer, the gentleman on the flyer was unable to make it. And this gentleman was more than gracious enough to step up. I had the honor of hearing him speak. He came up and spoke at our Friday night speaker meeting. And he made it clear that he does not like to tell a story. He prefers to speak on steps. So your wish is our command, Tom. We really appreciate you coming up. So we have Tom coming up to do steps 8 and 9. Come on up, Tom.
Hi, everybody. I'm an alcoholic. My name's Tom.
Hey, Tom.
And it's wonderful to be here today. There's probably some other places I could be, and probably some other stuff I could be doing on a Saturday afternoon. But there's probably no better place I could be, and probably nothing better that I could be doing. I love Alcoholics Anonymous. It didn't just save my life. It changed it into one worth living. And I'm just truly grateful for that. When I first got here, I thought I wanted my whole life back. Thank God I didn't get that. He changed my life. First of all, I want to apologize. Normally, there's this idea that you get what you pay for, and I know I'm not supposed to be here. So that being said, though, I am a supporter of our second legacy in the seventh tradition. So if somebody feels like they want their money back, how long do I have, like 2 hours, 4:30, five, like whatever time that is, I'm going to ask that you not go to the group and ask for your partial refund for this talk, but just come to me and we'll work it out. If I owe you a buck or two, we'll take care. I'll take care of that. So I am here just kind of filling in at the last minute. But once again, grateful to do, to be able to do service. The fine print, the legalese. I'm an alcoholic. My name is Tom Roach. My sobriety date is June 26th of 2001. And my home group is the Central Fact Group, which meets Friday night in Deerfield Beach, Florida, at St. Ambrose Church at 7:30. If you're looking for a nice little intimate meeting of about 300 people, and you're down there, we'd love to see you on a Friday night and talk about the Central Fact. It's been mentioned. It's been mentioned here today, right? I'm nervous. If anybody knows me, I get nervous when I speak. I thought I would outgrow it. That hasn't happened. I'm guessing now it's not going to. So what I've developed over the years is a little thing that I do to get out of that. And I usually, if it was a step series or something, I'd be doing something about a step. And it's usually something from the grapevine, not always. Today, it actually is something from the grapevine about step 9. So I think I'm supposed to do 8 and 9, right? Yeah. Step schmaps, I don't know, they're all different numbers. all right, so let's see. This is AA Grapevine, which means non-conference approved, right? A new AA member was having trouble sleeping because he felt guilty for cheating on his income taxes. His sponsor suggested he make amends, so he sent the IRS the following letter. Dear sir or madam, I cheated on my taxes and cannot sleep until I make amends. Enclosed is a check for $500. Sincerely, a reformed citizen. We get good, right? Oh, wait a minute. P.S. If I still can't sleep, I'll send you the balance. Yeah. That sounds a little more alcoholic, right? Yeah. And I think I know where that comes from. If I'm not mistaken, in the big book, I think Bill put, we make the best arrangements possible. Yeah, I think that's what he's talking about. It's an honor to be here and blessed. I've got a number of heroes in the room, myself. A number of these guys I've been following around. I remember, the last speaker, I guess 8-9 years ago, somebody came to me and asked me if I'd ever heard of him, and I hadn't. And they said, you got to go see him. And I was doing a step series somewhere. And like, people say that all the time, stuff like that, whatever. I'm like, okay. And I was on 6 and 7, what he just did. And like four people came up to me in 2 weeks and said, by the way, you need to go hear this guy. You need to go hear this guy. And I went and heard him, and I caught him finishing up a series of doing step 12, and then followed him around every week for 2 years, usually down to Miami, with a car of sponsees, and followed him around. And the speaker right before that was probably the last speaker I followed around. That was about six years coming up, I guess, this spring. And speaker coming up to do 12, I knew him before I knew any of those other guys. I've been following him around for a long time because he's a big book thumper like I am, and we attract each other. and I just feel, so I feel blessed on the one hand to be here, and on the other hand, I'm like, I feel like I should just be getting these guys coffee, like, what am I doing up here? I need to loosen this thing up. By the way, this decoration that I'm wearing, it's actually more than artistic, so in case you've just been admiring it. I call it a torture device. My occupational therapist calls it the healer. And so I went to, in the spring, I went to an automobile accident in March. And I forgot to bring a car. I am here to report that the automobiles remain undefeated. So they say that smart people learn by their mistakes, but really wise people learn by the mistakes of others. So I have a suggestion for all of you. And if you're going to be in a car accident, bring a car. We don't do well with that. So I got broken up from head to toe, and I was out of work for a few months and then part-time for a few months, and now I just went back full-time like a month or so ago, and starting to get back on my feet a little. So I haven't done as much of this as I used to do, and a bunch of things happened. I had some head trauma and broke a bunch of stuff, and anyway, so my head's a little different now. And so, like I said, I've always gotten nervous, but now I get more nervous. And a lot more emotional. I watch a Publix commercial and I'm like, they show me a commercial with kites and butterflies and puppies and kittens and I'm done, the ASPCA commercial comes on and I gotta I had to stop watching because I couldn't afford the Kleenex, it's just something just happened, and I don't know how that, I don't know. I know he's doing a work in me, and I know that if he wanted to punch my ticket that day, he could have inconspicuously done it, and nobody would have said a thing, So obviously he's got something that, for whatever reason, I'm still supposed to be around here. I see some young people in the room, in case you're wondering and thinking, this old guy, what the hell am I going to relate to him? I know all about the face space and the flitter. Yeah. Although now you're on that new stuff like Snapshit. Half a gram. Yeah. So I feel you. I am so down with that. I got you. And I see some people here my age too. You can probably relate to. I remember when I first started drinking, and it was like Bally High, Boone's Farm, Ripple, all those things. And I know that some of you younger guys are, you know, like real into the environment and everything. And I think I can pretty much assure you that no actual grapes were harmed in the making of Ripple, Bally High, or Boone's Farm Apple. You know, we weren't doing any environmental harm out there. But one of the cool things about AA is that, you know, alcoholism is non-discriminatory. You know, as Peter says, Park Avenue, Park Bench, you know. You know, it doesn't matter, you know, high, low, you know, black, white, rich, poor, like, you know, Catholic, Jew, it just doesn't matter, you know. You know, it'll take us down from wherever. This 8 and 9 is an interesting deal. You know, just for me, I look at the steps. Oh, by the way, where's Dan? Did he leave already? Yeah, he's heard me before. he knows. I don't think that was exactly what I said. But I know what you heard, and I know how that is. I said there is one story I like. I just said there's a story that I like better than my own, telling my own story, and that's the story of AA. And that probably is my favorite story, and, you know, some of you, if I'm doing a history or traditions thing, may have heard me do that, which is from a couple talks that Bill Wilson did in the 50s, 54, but most specifically one he did in 51. That's like my favorite AA talk, and it just reminds me that I hope I never get to the point where what's unbelievable is no longer unremarkable. I am more awestruck and more in wonder of Alcoholics Anonymous and a God in my life today than I ever was. You know, one of the brilliance of the steps is that it's wide enough. They're wide enough for almost all who suffer to enter, and yet deep and profound and rich enough that you can stay here for a lifetime and find something deeper to get into and something more to practice in your lives. Having a solution that's that wide and that open to entry for the newcomer, and yet that deep and rich and profound for somebody who's been here for 50 or 60 years, is mind-boggling. I remember, you know, some people here know me. I'm into the literature and into the history. And a couple of years ago, I was at the, or a few years ago now, I guess, the AA History Symposium, and I was talking to Mel B. Some of you may know who that is, Mel Barger. There's a book in Alcoholics Anonymous called Pass It On, The Story of Bill Wilson and How the AA Message Reached the World, and that's the guy that wrote it. He's been sober 67 years, you know, been sober a little while. And I remember asking him, you know, talking to him. I saw him at the International, but I was also with 60,000 of my closest friends, so we didn't get to talk. But at this history symposium, I did get to talk to him, and I asked him, you know, you've been around a long time, so now he's sober 67 years. At the time, he was sober 64 years when we were talking. And I said, you know, what is the most amazing thing? You know, what has surprised you the most about Alcoholics Anonymous? I mean, you wrote the history. And when I say the history, we have other books like Dr. Bob and the Good Old Timers, which is about Dr. Bob and the Good Old Timers, you know, in the Midwest. Pass It On, the subtitle for that is Pass It On, The Story of Bill Wilson and How the AA Message Reached the World, which is you and me, right? And then we have AA Comes of Age, ostensibly about the St. Louis 1955 convention, but really a history of all three legacies, you know, recovery, unity, and service. But when I asked him, what was the most amazing thing about Alcoholics Anonymous? What has surprised you the most over the past, you know, 64 years? And he said that something so fragile has lasted for so long. And it reminds me, what a powerful reminder, that I need to be a good steward of the faith, a good steward of the trust, that there's a responsibility for me, that we have something here that is so incredible, like incalculably priceless, and it's never existed before. You know, there was one time, you know, in the mid-1800s, you know, between 1840 and 1848, it's only been two wholesale movements for the recovery of alcoholics in the history of mankind, the Washingtonians, the Washington Temperance Society, and Alcoholics Anonymous. And one of them is extinct, and you're sitting in the other one. You know, we hear a lot of stories That's what we're sober by anecdote. We're a society that's sober by anecdote. You know, we're people that are confounding to normie earth people, whatever out there. You know, we trace tragedy into anecdote and somehow emerge joyful. And we have this thing that's just so precious, and it still is fragile. Although it's survived everything. You know, it's survived civil rights and equal rights and world wars and great recessions and everything else. And, you know, I think Bob Pearson said it best, the general service manager in 1985 when he was leaving, and he said, the thing that we really have to fear is not the druggy buggies in the treatment centers and this or that. What we have to fear is ourselves. That Alcoholics Anonymous is about becoming too rigid, and if we were going to destroy ourselves, it would be from the inside out. And it's a reminder that I need to be a good steward of what is so sacred. You know, one of the things that was talked about is, you know, Russell talked about last about being reborn. You know, it's the last line in the third step promises about being reborn. You know, most people only get, they get one life inside of one lifetime, but somehow we get two lives inside of one lifetime. You know, that my life got changed into one worth living. Russell said something, and every once in a while I hear it in the rooms or something. And he said something, he said this line, he said, most men lead lives of quiet desperation. And maybe you've heard that before. I hear it sometimes in the rooms, but I never hear the rest of it. That line is from Walden. It's from Henry David Thoreau. And what he said was, most men lead lives of quiet desperation and go to their graves with their songs still in their hearts. They never get to sing their song. That's what Alcoholics Anonymous allows us to do. And the way it allows us to do that is by having a change mechanism after we stop drinking. You know, we talked about, you know, in you know, last session's talking about, you know, not drinking, you know, early on. But then we have all this other stuff that's going on that's killing us. Now, I know that we say that the Big Book doesn't talk about alcohol after step one. That's not true. The Big Book never stops talking about alcohol. When we go to the last line of the eighth step is, or the second to last line, is that the last line of the eighth step is, remember that we agreed to go to any lengths for victory over alcohol. The first line of the 12th step is, practical experience shows that nothing will so much ensure immunity from drinking as intensive work with other alcoholics. So I know there's this thing that goes on in the rooms about after step one, the Big Book doesn't address drinking, but the Big Book never stops talking about drinking, because it is the firm foundation upon which all the other steps are built. So I have a chronic, progressive, incurable, ultimately fatal disease. If I continue to drink, I'm going to die. And oh, here's the rub, I can't stop drinking. The first step is a death sentence, you know. And I'm not going to spend time qualifying, you know. What I remember is a lot of my friends telling me that I needed to cut back or stop, whichever. I interpreted it as cut back. But they're all like, you know, your drinking's getting in the way of work. You need to watch that. You need to stop that. And they were right. They were absolutely right. And work had to go. You know, I'm not a guy who lets things like work or my marriage or my having the car or the house or anything get in the way of that. If I relapse, you'll know it. I'm not going to relapse on Friday night and pick up a white chip Saturday. If I relapse, I'm gone. Good, I'm just gone. You know, that's my history. So if I get the first step, I have a death sentence. So I kind of better hope that there's a second step. My transition, the downward spiral of alcoholism, is the transition from the optimist who is occasionally wrong to a pessimist who is always right. And a pessimist who is always right is a man without hope. And hope is the possibility of a better future self. And I come into Alcoholics Anonymous, into a room, and there's a culture of rising spiritual expectations. Hope is available here. And for the hopeless, I don't know that there's anything more important. I don't know how it works or why it works or any of that. But what I do is I look, I see my first sponsor, I remember, I hear a story, and he's a man just like me, and he has a story just like me. But he's a man and I'm a boy. He's nothing like me anymore. And there's something different. God sends angel after angel, it seems. It's like, you know, whether it's the mother, the father, the sister, the brother, the partner, the lover, the friends, the enemies, the judges, the lawyers, whoever it is, everybody has said, go get help, go get help, go get help. And my eyes don't see and my ears don't hear. And then somehow I walk into Alcoholics Anonymous and I hear a message, but it's a message from an angel with a broken wing. And a message with an angel from a broken wing makes this whole thing possible. Because they have a broken wing, and it was possible for them. And I know I have a broken wing, so maybe it's possible for me. But when I hear it from somebody else out there, it just doesn't have the same thing. It just doesn't work. And there's a chapter for a guy like me. We agnostics, you know, was referenced in the last session. And it kind of says, get over it. But it's written for a guy like me. It says, be willing to get over it. And by the time I get to the end of that chapter, it turns out that the biggest difference between me and God is that he does not suffer the delusion that he is me. You know, that's a pretty big difference, right? And I don't believe. I come in here with contempt prior to investigation and a clenched fist. I'm the unbeliever. And I really don't want to hear that part. I remember people were saying to me, you know, you need to, you know, get into the spiritual. And I'm like, no, I'm going to work the intellectual part of the program. You know, I'm a thinker. Some people in here know me. My sponsor tells me that what goes on up here is pretty much for entertainment purposes only. But, you know, guys know I'm a driller. You know, I'm drilling to literature, drilling to whatever it is. Think about it to death, right? And then resurrect it and think about it some more, you know. But I couldn't think myself sober. And in the second step, it talks about that the bridge of reason does not extend to the shore of faith, the implication being that there will have to be some type of leap beyond reason, you know. And I tell him that, and thank God he second stepped me right there. You know, that was a while ago. He was, you know, whatever, 22 years sober at the time. And he just said, are you willing to believe? Because I tell him I don't believe, and I'm afraid, because I've been going to meetings for months, and everybody that I hear, you know, they talk about a spiritual program and a higher power, and I don't believe, so how can this thing be available to me? And he had the wisdom to second step me. He said, are you willing to believe? And I said, yeah, I'm willing. He said, that's all it's going to take to get started. And he was right. And I take that step on the backs of the AAs that have gone before me that says it works for them. You know, it's suggested that I start to pray. I'm like, what would that look like? Didn't I make that clear? I don't believe. I said, pray anyways. I was like, well, how's that going to be? And I was following a big book thumper around at the time, Jim B. I don't know if anybody, I know a couple of people in here that would know him. Right, Pat? You know, and yeah. And he was an attorney, and I have his 39-year medallion. But he died with 40 years. But anyways, he was sponsored by Admiral Bud S., who was sponsored by Bill. And I had never heard the big book talked about like that. I followed him around until he died. Oh, yeah, you know him, man. And so, what was that? What was I saying? It was a WTF moment. Like, did I mention I hurt my head? In March, I hurt myself in March. My accident, my grand sponsor was in town. He was speaking up in Delray for some anniversary thing, and I saw him. And then the next day I got hit. And I'm involved in this big book seminar that I do every year with Pat, what used to be the Joe and Charlie big book seminar. And they brought me in there, whatever, 6 or 7 years ago, something, to do the history of AA. And then they asked me to do some other stuff. But I was brought in to do that, and that was in May, and it was like less than 2 months after my accident, and at the time I couldn't really talk because I lost my short-term memory, and some people in here know me. I can remember some shit. I can remember some stuff. you know. And then, you know, and I've read the book, you know, and taken a legion of guys through it, but I can't hold on to what I'm thinking about. So if somebody reminds me, I can go completely on that for a half hour, but I can't remember what I was talking about a couple minutes ago sometimes. And in the beginning, it was so bad so I had a bunch of guys, all sponsees, they're all sitting in the front row at the big book seminar reminding me about what I'm talking about so that I can keep a talk going, you know? So it is getting better. I know it didn't sound like that, but it's getting better. So the thing is, you know, we're sober by anecdote, and we follow stories. That's what we follow. And the stories are all about this, like, coming to believe. And so I find out that there's a lot of people like me that suffer the same thing, that they're not believers. So when I want to work the intellectual part of the program, what I come to find out is that trying to work the intellectual part of the program, it's just a spiritual program. You know, it's like trying to swim in the non-wet part of the ocean. Like, how does that work, you know? And but that's where I am, and that's where I start. But I start the prayer thing, and I start to pray, and I don't know how to pray. And what Jimmy recommended was pray to whom it may concern, to God if you're there. And I ask, please keep me away from a drink today or anything else that I might use. I have some other things that I have some other stuff I use, you know, non-conference approved. So I would ask for that, and then I would go the day, and I wouldn't have anything. And at night, I would say, I'd hit my knees, and I'd say, to whom it may concern, to God, if you're there, thank you for another day clean and sober. And it started out so simply, and I would be sporadic for a little bit. And then what I would notice is that when I missed it, my days weren't the same. They just weren't the same. Now, I probably haven't missed a day on my knees in about 14 years. I'm no longer doing it because it's suggested. You know, my life just works better. My life works better. My prayer life, you know, there's many ways that my sobriety has changed, but I don't know if it's that anything has changed more dramatically than that, my 11-step life. And I think that's a natural part of the step progression, and I see it happen for lots of people, and we heard it here from the podium earlier. And then the third step, this decision, it's talked about just as a decision in the big book in the 12 and 12. By the time he's 18 years sober versus 4 years sober, he considers it an action step. And I did get down on my knees with my sponsor, and I took that step. And I took that step based on enough knowledge sufficient to take action, even though it still didn't satisfy my intellect. But what I found was that I could move forward without this having to satisfy the thinking part, which is something I always had to do before. So that might not sound like a big deal, but I always had to reason myself through stuff and then decide, like, whether or not I want to do it. That doesn't work well in here. You know, there were a lot of things I didn't understand or wasn't fully accepting, but I kept moving forward. And that is a process, and it would come as I moved on. In four, you know, four is the beginning of authenticity. You know, to start, you know, this, my experience with the steps is that it's a, you know, this, in four it talks about specifically an effort to find the truth and face the truth so that I can engage in a process to accept the truth. And, if four is the beginning of authenticity, five is the end of rationalization. That I'm going to take the truth as I see it to the filter of sponsorship and run that through them, and they're going to help separate the wheat from the chaff. And I think of myself as like a pretty passive guy. Like I'm like a nice guy. Like I like people like me, kites and butterflies, puppies and kittens, you know. Like, but it turns out in that fourth step, something was revealed. Something was revealed as I did step five, and what it was is that I was an intellectual bully. You know, I think of myself as a nice guy. But what showed up in the fourth and fifth steps was that I never met an argument I didn't like. You know, like, I would walk into a bar and order a drink, and the next thing I would do is be listening for an argument. And I would just run over there and be like, hey, is this a private argument, or can anybody just jump right in? And it was on. You know, and I don't care. Hey, it could have been string theory or quantum physics. I may have been often wrong, but I was rarely in doubt. You know, I mean, I was just there, and it was on, and I just loved to argue. And My sponsor wound up helping me a lot with that, and you know, a lot of 10-step work actually, which applied to that. And when I came in here, I started doing it. I stopped doing it on about religion and politics, and I started doing it with the big book. As I became what they call a big book thumper, I think that's a loving, is that an endearing term? I don't know what that is. But as I became that guy who reads the book and carries the book, and you know, it's like you're a thumper, Tom, like it or not, you know. And I started to argue about that. I took the same thing, even though I'm not drinking, I take the same argumentative stuff, and I want to do it about spiritual principles. You want to argue? Let me get this straight. You want to argue a spiritual principle to death, right? And that has the same results. And that is I'm fairly good at arguing. and that's not a compliment, by the way. But the problem with that is that you win the war and you lose the peace. Like, you were right. You got the victory, and they said, uncle. And you walk away, and somehow you feel like you need a shower. Like, I need a shower after doing what I just did to win that argument, you know? So it wasn't fitting in here, and my sponsor helped me out a lot with that, and I've left that behind for the most part. Yeah. Right. You know, we get to 6 and 7, and, you know, and Russell just talked about that. You know, 6 and 7, I have deep resentment. You know, he actually read it, you know, the first paragraph of the step 6, and it talks about a noted clergyman, a friend, that this is the step that separates the men from the boys. And I had abandoned my religion of origin, and, you know, that guy was Father Ed Dowling, a Jesuit priest, and I was pissed right off the start. It's like, what are you doing inviting him into my AA, you know? And I really didn't like that, but it turned out that he was right, you know, the step that separates the men from the boys. And it's so interesting in AA that, like, we get this step. It's only a paragraph, step 6 in the big book, and just like step 7, you know, one paragraph. And it says, are you willing to get rid of these things that are objectionable? And we say yes. And it says, all of them say yes. And I think, in a sense, that I am, but the truth of 6 is revealed in 7. And it turns out I'm negotiating the surrender, you know, that I'm not truly ready to give it all up, and he allows me to hold on to whatever it is I want to hold on to. But that's not revealed until 7, you know, until I realize that I've taken the 7-step prayer, I've gotten on my knees and gotten up, and he hugs me, but I don't get the lightning strike. I feel different. But I somehow intuitively know that everything has not been lifted from me. You know? And Russell talked about that stuff a lot. You know, even though I'm not drinking and not using none of that stuff, that there's this other stuff. And I see it. You know, I've been blessed to work with lots of guys. And, you know, it could be whatever it is. You know, oftentimes for the gals, it's retail therapy, purses and pumps, you know. And... you know, for the guys, maybe it's NFL gambling on bruises and bumps. You know, it doesn't matter. It's this, like, leaking in other areas of my life. And I watch guys go through that a lot, and what happens is usually it catches up and wind up going back out anyways. Wind up going back out over that stuff about the leaking, you know, where everything's not, like, sealed down. I remember taking those steps and not dismissing their significance, because I took them out of the big book and they're just a paragraph. And it seems like I, you know, do 6 and 7 and, like, out of here. And you know, and that's at 4 years sober. But by the time he's 18 years sober, you know, and he's writing in the 12 and 12, you know, the first step has gone from half of the basic text for the steps, you know, like 50 plus pages of devoted to step 1, And that's gone to, you know, 3.5 chapters have gone to 3.5 pages in the 12 and 12. And seven lines for step six and seven lines for step seven have gone to 7 pages. So there's a tremendous change between years 4 and 18, you know, with Bill. And it's all about, like, the other stuff. It's not about the drinking. He's not drinking. You know, Bill Wilson had a conversion experience. Now, that didn't mean that that didn't mean character defects were lifted. He talks about it in two ways. There were two things that were lifted, or two things that happened. One was his obsession to drink, which only he said came back once in the Mayflower Hotel. But the other thing that happened in that spiritual experience was that he felt convicted of the presence of God and never doubted that conviction for the rest of his life, regardless of the ups and downs that he would go through. And he went through a lot. You know, Russell talked about this idea about all this other stuff, about this stuff going on, about worshiping this and worshiping that. And it always reminds me of how the steps work. You know, when we look at the steps, you know, when I first, you know, when I get sober, let me look. You know what, I should probably read some stuff, right? Like, if I read some stuff out of the 12 and 12 or the big book, and they're on steps 8 and 9, then I could actually say that I touched on steps 8 and 9, right?
Yes.
Right. Let's see, how should I do this? When do I talk to him?
5 o'clock.
Yeah. You be careful, some people in here know me. when do I talk to Dad? I don't know what time my story
starts. 2:30.
Oh, you know. Okay, 3:30? Okay. All right, thank you. I can still tell time. I know how to do that. Yeah. I tell it slowly. It takes about 25 hours a day, but I can tell. So there's all this other stuff going on in six. And in six, there's a question asked. He didn't read it, but it goes along with what was being shared. And that was that why, when we have been so relieved of our alcoholism, like 100%, and when I say alcoholism, I mean drinking, the drinking part of it, we've been relieved 100%, why don't we get the same total 100% relief with the rest of what's going on? In step six, Bill called it the riddle of our existence. It's like baffling how we can't like get this other stuff out, whether it's shopping or porn or, you know, cheating, gambling, whatever it is, you know, why can't that stuff be relieved? And he said, that's the riddle of our existence. And then he says, it's maybe because we actually like them to some point. But we just, like, for many of us, we'll struggle with that stuff for years. And the steps, although I mentioned they don't actually ever abandon the drinking, alcohol will be present right through step 12. That's just the way the big book is written, you know. But nevertheless, it's going to spend a lot more time talking about these other things, and he's going to continue to talk about those other things forever. And one of the reasons that my experience is that they're so important is that when I get here, I suffered the delusion that not total delusion, but I feel like I'm punished for my sins. But my experience, a deeper experience than that, is I'm punished by my sins. And if that's true, and I'm punished by the very nature of what I'm doing that's wrong, these character defects, then that would mean that if I'm continuing to act on them, I'm continuing to be punished for them or pay the price for them, even though I've stopped drinking. And for me, the way I look at that, that makes it easy to look at, is that you can think of somebody robbing something and getting caught and going to jail or whatever, and that's being punished for your sin. That's the obvious punishment, right? But there's a deeper punishment, and that is that the punishment of the thief is that his goods are never safe. He can't trust anybody about that. The punishment of the liar is he can't believe anyone. If he's lying, everybody's lying, right? The punishment of the adulterer is he can't trust his partner. If he's cheating, she's cheating. That's being punished by your sins. Just not whether you get caught or not, because of this compass that we have, this place, this hole in the soul, this moral compass, this thing we're trying to fill that we can't find, right? I think that when I walk in here, I just walk in here with the problem. But if I believe what the big book says and we agnostic, it says actually we were fooling ourselves. For deep down in every man, woman, and child is the fundamental idea of God. It may be obscured by pomp, calamity, or other circumstances. If that's true, not only did I walk in here with the problem, but I walked in here with the solution. Unbeknownst to me, how the hell can I find it? Buried beneath my selfishness, my dishonesty, my resentment and fear. What a great place to hide it on the alcoholic, right? But in this process, when I go down there and start to find that and discover that, it turns out that what I'm looking for, I'm looking with. That it's already there. But as it says in spiritual experience, an untapped, unsuspected resource. And what the steps are designed is to open me up to that resource and get away the stuff. You know, when I come here, I think it's about information. Like I need to add this and add that. But are the steps really about getting more information? I'm not missing much information, maybe other than the doctor's opinion, you know, the allergy, the obsession of mind, and the allergy of the body, right? It turns out, and what he says is that actually the main problem with the alcoholic centers in his mind. Probably the best that I ever heard of that, best expression was the South African activist, Stephen Biko, who said, the most powerful tool in the hands of the oppressor is the mind of the oppressed. My alcoholism, it gets me through my head. Not my heart, it gets me through my mind, right? So I need to have my mind changed, and part of that is opening up. So in the beginning of the steps, what I'm doing is looking for the truth. First, to find the truth about God, you know? I come here in a state of, you know, defiance, resistance, rebellion, and somehow I got to get to a state of acceptance, belief, and obedience. And that's really the first three steps. And that will open me up to whatever it is he needs to do. Now, I've already been cracked open. Hopefully, that's the gift of desperation. Because he needs to be able to get in there and do a work on me. And in the beginning, that sounds so foreign, making the decision to turn myself over to that. But don't we do it all the time? Hey, guess what? As a guy who just, you know, got run over by a car, I know all about that. You know, I go into a room, I turn my life over to a higher authority, they give me some anesthesia, and they put me under, and they repair or remove damaged parts to make me usefully whole, and then send me back out into the world. That's like a lot that goes, like, similar to what goes on in the steps, right? I turn my life over to a higher authority who repairs and removes damaged parts and makes me hopefully, happily, and usefully whole and sends me back out into the world. Now, the difference is that in here, we don't actually give you the anesthesia, you know? So the operation hurts a little bit, but that's part of it, because there's so much work to be done on this other stuff. And the other stuff is killing me, and I'm punished for it, whether I got caught or not, if I subscribe to that theory that I'm punished by my sins. So the first thing is to find out the truth about God. You know, my idea about God has changed 180 degrees. You know, he's not counting my sins. He doesn't love me because I'm getting good through the steps. He loves me because he's good. I think 6 and 7 say get good. 6 and 7 say get close. Get close to him who has the power. And all this, and that whole story of AA and the steps was revealed to us in There's a Solution, where it said The fact is that for reasons yet obscure, most alcoholics have lost the power of choice in drink, which means that if when I want to, I find I cannot quit entirely, or if when drinking, I have little control over the amount I take, I'm probably alcoholic. I come in here and hear the tremendous fact. The fact is that you guys have found a way out, a common solution upon which you all agree, have engaged in brotherly and harmonious to take the 12 steps to a spiritual. What is that? What have you engaged in? What does that mean? The great fact is just this and nothing less, that you've had deep and effective spiritual experiences which have revolutionized your whole attitude toward life, toward your fellows, and towards God's universe. Which means ideas and attitudes and emotions, which used to be the guiding force of your life, have been cast to one side, and a whole new set of motives and conceptions begins to dominate them. Really? What's at the heart of those new motives and conceptions? The central fact of my life today is the absolute certainty that my Creator has entered into my heart and lives there in a way which is indeed miraculous and has commenced to do for me that which I could never have done for myself. Namely, relieve me of the obsession, restore me to sanity through a personal relationship with a power that does for me what I cannot do for myself. I haven't even reached step one in the big book, but I've been given the whole program and the four facts, and there's a solution, right? And now I need to dive into that further. So in 6 and 7, the idea is that I'm going to get close to that who has the power to make me change. And what have I learned by then? I've learned, beginning to learn the truth about God. I'm learning the truth about myself in 4 and 5, right? Discovering that. And when I say the truth about myself, I don't know if anybody remembers, but when we get to the fifth step promises, one of the things it says when we go home to get quiet for an hour and prepare ourselves for step 6, it says we thank God from the bottom of our hearts that we know Him better. Wait a minute, I just did all this stuff on 4 and 5 on me. Thank you that I know Him better, because that's the way the steps are designed. You know, we hear about the steps being like old ideas and from religion and whatnot, and I know where the steps came from. In 1953, Bill wrote an article, a fragment of AA history, where the 12 steps came from. The author and architect of that legacy told me where he took the steps. I know where they came from. But this idea has been around forever, that I need to be relieved of this stuff. And so some of this idea, the brilliance of the steps is not that the ideas are new, it's the presentation of the ideas. There's never been a presentation of the ideas like the 12 steps are presented in the big book on the planet until that happens. That's unique. Now, we've let many 12-step organizations use it, but that's something that happened in AA. Those ideas, maybe old ideas from religion, from various places, from philosophy, medicine, but they've never been presented like that. So what happens is I'm at this stage where I'm asking for Him to remove this stuff, and what I've done is I've found the truth about myself, the truth about God. And then when I find the truth about God and the truth about myself and have gone through 4 and 5, asked Him to remove what's blocking me off from Him and doing what He would have me do, that I get to step 8. And when I get to step 8, right, made a list of persons we had harmed, became willing to make amends to them all, I have the information I need from through 4 through 7 about all these different people, maybe some institutions also. So what I'm finding out is the truth about God, the truth about myself, and what's revealed in that is the truth about my relationships. Now, the cool thing about that is that the truth about God and the truth about myself and the truth about my relationships, that's the truth about everything. There's nothing else. Surrender or be surrendered. You're not leaving here with anything. When you leave, the only thing that you will leave is what you gave away. That's it. You know, surrender or be surrendered. Right? The truth about God, the truth about myself, and the truth about my relations. And when I see the truth about my relations, what's revealed to me is that there is more than my drinking and my using in the way of my relationships with all these people. And what I find is it's the very stuff in 6 and 7 that I'm asking Him to remove, and yet somehow I want to negotiate the surrender and not give it all up. What Bill calls instincts in collision. You know, Russell hinted at it. He said there's an article actually that Bill wrote called Emotional Sobriety, The Next Frontier, in January of 1958. And he said in that what he talks about is unhealthy dependencies, and that's true. But he goes further. What he talks about is unhealthy dependencies and their consequent unhealthy demands. And it's that that wrecks our relationships with other people. And what he talks about in that article is that we become part of the healing circuit. And the healing circuit is where we can transmit love to others and receive love from God, and then receive love from others and pass it back up and become part of that healing circuit. And the only way, so how does Alcoholics Anonymous, in the Ninth Step Promises, especially talking about 8 and 9, right? In the Ninth Step Promises, it says fear of people and of economic insecurity will leave us. If that's true, that means that you can solve an economic problem without money. Really? I never knew a financial problem that couldn't be solved with money and or that could be solved with anything other than money. So how does it do that? By spiritually reducing our demands. So I'm not guaranteed, it doesn't talk about being economically insecure, it talks about not being afraid of it anymore. So what I've got to do is get rid of all of these things that 6 and 7 that I might say, well, at least I'm not drinking. But the problem is that that's not really going to repair my relationships with others. And 8 is all about seeing the truth about my relationships, and what I see there is the harm done. You know, I remember when I was, I make that list, and the mechanics of the list were that I went through it with my sponsor, and that we took it, you know, if I've been thorough in 4 through 7, I have all the information there that I need, and we made the list, and we made it into willing to make right now, willing to make later, willing to make maybe, willing to make never, you know, no how, no way. So it was like now, later, maybe, never, right? And I would pray for the willingness. So the 8th step is a prayer step, by the way. So that's what it says in the big book. It says we go out and make amends to these people, and if we haven't the willingness to do it, we ask for it, which is big book code for pray. So just like the 6th step is a prayer step. If we haven't the willingness to let go of these things that are objectionable, we pray for it. Prayer is riddled throughout the steps. We always talk about 3, 7, 11, but it shows up everywhere. And so as I start to make amends that were like later move into now, amends that were maybe move into later, amends that were never hopefully move into maybe, and then later, and then now. I remember I used to always think that I would go home and my sisters would want to talk about my father, who was an alcoholic and died a long time ago, and they would always drag it through the mud, and I'd always resist and defend him and all that crap. And after I go through the work, that stops happening. And I think that finally they've all changed. Well, what happened is I stopped bringing that to the conversation. They're probably sitting around saying, I can't believe Tom finally stopped talking about Dad. Like every time I think that it's them, it's really me. And after I got cleared and no longer had those instincts in collision where I have to resist and defend the position and make the arguments just stopped, right? So I remember, you know, I was around a year and I was making my amends, and and I'd been in a really bad accident. So I relapsed 18 years ago in January. It was my last relapse, right? And I was in a bad accident that spring in 99. And then I got sober in 2001, like I said, and I came down here. But I was always afraid that might catch up on me. It showed up on my 4-step and whatnot because it was a bad accident, multiple vehicles and a truck, and a couple of people got really hurt, like this crap. And sure enough, I get a letter, and the letter is that says that you might have to come back to Pittsburgh for a deposition. I'm down here. And I talked to my sponsor about it, and I'm really worried about it. He can tell that. And he says, you know, well, you don't know if it's going to happen. Right now, you just need to get busy and go help somebody. Now, the thing is, I've picked up my 1-year medallion. So the guys that did the intervention on me when I came down here, some fraternity brothers, They made me sign over my car. It was my last thing. And I had to sign over my car to have enough money to go to rehab, because back then I had just been to rehab and relapsed, and they didn't do it like they do it now. You know, you get so many days a year and you're done. And so I had a real resentment to these guys because they took my car to make me pay for another rehab, since insurance wouldn't pay again, a flight down to Florida the first couple weeks at a halfway and all that. And they take my car and they say, we'll pay for all this to get you going, and then we'll sell your car and send you the money and a few $1,000, whatever you make out of it. And I keep calling them for the money, and they're like, yeah, we can't sell the car, we can't sell the car. And I'm like, furious. I'm like, out of my mind, I want my money. And my resentment is so bad that I'm like, I gotta make those amends. And I couldn't make them at a year, and then I couldn't make them at 18 months. And 2 years comes up, and I can't pick up my medallion. Starting to talk a little bit, starting to sponsor guys, starting to do this and that, and in the program, but I'm not sharing about this resentment that I have for these guys. I'm not willing to make amends. I am praying for it, but I'm still unwilling to make the amends, and I just won't make it. And I'm so spiritually sick inside that I cannot go and pick up a 2-year medallion because I think I'm a fraud in Alcoholics Anonymous. I know I am, right? And I can't, I still got those instincts in collision. Now, I live my life forward, but I understand it backward, especially spiritually. And what I know today, what I learned, it took me a few years, is that, so why would I hold on to those things? It's the riddle of our existence. Why would I hold on to the very crap that's killing me? And I learned, after a few years, I come to the truth that the pain of the familiar becomes more comfortable than the uncertainty of the unknown. And I'd rather be driven by fear than challenged by faith. And I can't understand, and then after I know it, I still can't make the amends. And I don't know, like, why can't you do that? Why can't you do that? And now today, again, you know, live it forward, understand it backward, especially spiritually. And today I know that I won't let go of a resentment as long as I think I'm right. That's my problem. And hasn't that been my problem all along, that the steps are designed to handle? In step one, I need to learn that I'm wrong about my drinking, that I can't control it and enjoy it, that it no longer works. I'm not successful at it anymore, right? In step two, it's like I'm wrong about my idea of God that I've tucked away as a kid, you know, regarding my religion of origin and all that stuff. And I've tucked away a God in a little box that's an insufficient power to hijack a mental blank spot or solve my alcoholism, right, to bring about that personality change. And then four, I find out I'm wrong about everyone and everything. And in eight, I revisit that, how I'm wrong in my relationships, and that how am I going to go out and live new, healthy relationships without first learning how to do that? And how do I learn that? In going back and repairing old relationships that were damaged. I've been wrong about everything. The steps are about a willingness to be wrong, a series of never-ending surrenders. What was acceptable in year one wasn't acceptable in year three. What was acceptable in year three wasn't okay in five. What was okay in five wasn't okay in 10, and on, right? That's the narrowing of six and seven. It's not about drinking. I haven't had a drink. It's about getting, narrowing the gap with that other stuff that still gets in the way of my relationships with you, right? So I won't make, I'm sick. I'm spiritually sick in the rooms. I won't make the thing. And what happens is I'm real worried about this accident. What's going to happen legally? Then am I going to lose my license? Am I going to go to jail? Am I going to take all my money? Whatever that is. I'm living in a halfway house. Check to check, I have no money. And all of a sudden I'm at work one day, and there was a guy that was supposed to pick up a year that I was in the halfway house with, and he goes out. And he comes back in, and he can't get sober, and I hear a voice, and the voice says, do for him what was done for you. Give to him what was so freely given to you. I said to an attorney friend of mine who was getting sober at the time too, and I said to him, I got to help this guy. He's like, what are you talking about? He's a chronic relapser. I said, no, I heard the voice of God. He's like, you're freaking nuts. You didn't hear anything, and that guy doesn't, you know, that guy's a chronic relapser and he doesn't need your help. I'm like, no, I heard the voice of God. And I started out on a mission. And I started to help him, and I had a lot of trouble trying to 12-step him. Anybody try to 12-step somebody who's not, doesn't want to be a willing participant in their own rescue? Yeah. So that was a debacle. I wound up missing work and taking him to detox, and he's telling me he hasn't used, and I go, and then he shows up hot, and I can't get him in, and I turn to him, and I say, And I turn to the tech and say, no, that can't be. He told me he didn't use. Like, you'd think I'd know better by then, right? Like, the tech just looked at me like, are you freaking insane? How long have you been sober? You know? And so it takes me a few days, a couple efforts, different times, and hospital trips and whatnot. But I get him in. And then a couple weeks later, the guy that told me not to help him, that attorney guy that I was getting sober with, he had like 8 months or something. And he calls me from a crack shack motel down in Pompano. At 7:30 in the morning, I'm on my way to work. And I did something that we don't recommend, and I made a 12-step call by myself. I'm spiritually fit. It's not a good idea. I don't recommend it. But I went, and I threw his crap out, and I took him to the same detox. And on the way, he's telling me what a loser the other guy is. And I'm like, yeah, the only difference between you two is he's been sober 2 weeks longer than you. He's in detox. And he's like, I need you to call my mother, and I can't talk to her. And he was whacked. He couldn't talk. And I got on the phone with his mother, and his mother says, can I call you tonight? I said, yes. And she called me every night. She called me every night that week, and we talked for a half hour, an hour. You know, when I relapsed, like I said, 18 years ago, I had been sober for 5 years. Some of you know what that's like to go out after you've been sober for a while, the shame and the guilt with my family. And my brother got me on the phone, and he said, he started reading me the Riot Act. How could you do this to her, meaning the future ex? How could you do this to us, meaning him and my sisters? And how could you do this to our mother? How could you do this to mom? And there I am, 5 years sober, in the rooms, you know, unencumbered by sponsorship, the steps, or a higher power. And with all the wisdom of a 10-year-old, you know, I said to him, you don't know a damn thing about this disease. It's my problem, and the only one I'm hurting is myself. That's what I had said to him. Now, here I am, a couple years later, right? This is 4 years later, 2 years of a relapse and 2 years in recovery, and I'm on the phone with his mother. Live my life forward, but I understand it backward, especially spiritually, and I talk to her every night that week. And I know now that my mother wasn't okay because she had a few other daughters that were doing good and a son that was doing good. I thought she was fine. Today I know that a mother is only as happy as her saddest child, and that woman went to bed every night waiting for a phone call to find out whether I was dead or alive. And I learned that week. I got him in rehab, and those guys came out shortly thereafter, and they didn't stay sober, but I got another letter, and it said I had to go up north for that deposition, and I was gonna be deposed, and I was gonna be in front of lawyers, and I was gonna be involved about that one accident, the one thing that I was on my four-step that I was deathly afraid of, that was gonna come up, and it came up. And I called my sponsor, and I said, I have a letter here, I have to go up to Pittsburgh, I'm gonna be deposed, and he said, and he goes, oh, hey, I know you're really worried about that, about losing your license, going to jail, money, never driving, all that stuff. Are you okay? Do you think you're going to drink? And he never talked to me like that. I wasn't brittle. And I remember saying to him that, no, it's not about that. It's not about any of that. I have a letter in my hand. I'm living in a halfway house, still paycheck to paycheck. And I said, I have a letter in my hand that says I have a flight to Pittsburgh. And when I get to Pittsburgh, I have a hotel to stay in. And when I get in that hotel, I have a per diem to get meals every day. And for the last few weeks, months now, I've been working with these two guys trying to get them sober. And for the first time, I know what those fraternity brothers went through when they were trying to help me all that time. And I wasn't a willing participant in my rescue. And they were doing for me what I couldn't do for myself. And the reason that I have all this in my hand, that I have to go back there, has nothing to do with the law or the accident or my license or anything. What it has to do with is that I'm ready to make amends to those two guys. And I went up north and I made those pair of amends that I was never going to make, that I just couldn't make. And I made those amends, and it's just unbelievable because I had stayed the course the whole time. I had prayed every night for the willingness to do it. You know, and I'd gone to meetings every day, and meeting by meeting, and page by page, and prayer by prayer, and step by step, and action by action, the God who pursues those who deny him interrupted my mediocre sobriety and revealed a new freedom, the likes of which I never could have imagined. I came back from up north making those amends, and my life exploded. And all of a sudden, I was speaking and sponsoring, and I changed my groups around, and I was alive in Alcoholics Anonymous, and because I had finally dealt with that stuff in 6 and 7, that stuff about needing to be right and I no longer needed to be right about that anymore, and it was okay to be wrong. A few years ago, 5 years ago or so, I went to Jim B's grave site with a guy that I work with that used to be sponsored with him, by him as well. And I said, I owe that guy a thanks. You know, he taught me the big book line by line, like I had never heard it before. And I want to go say thank you. And I brought a few medallions. And we got down on our knees. And I left three medallions there, one for him and one for me and one for the man who still suffers. And I left the man on the bed that they were talking about earlier. And on the back of that, it says, recovery begins when one alcoholic talks to another, sharing experience, strength, and hope, which is the last line, I think, of the forward to the third edition. And sometimes I hear that line isn't in the big book. It's in the big book. I've read that book. Yeah. I know alcoholics don't like Roman numerals, you know. we're bad with percentages. Four out of three alcoholics don't like Roman numerals. That was such an experience. I had such a powerful experience at Jim B's gravesite that I was going to go out a couple months later to Dr. Bob's gravesite, and I decided that I would leave a medallion because I can make a case, and I'm not doing a history thing here and I need to end this up, but I can build a case, and a number of you have been through the history series with me, about the Oxford Group being founded on the backs of amends by Frank Bookman. That's how the Oxford Group gets started, on the backs of the eighth and ninth step. And I can also make that case for Alcoholics Anonymous, because Dr. Bob's sobriety date initially is Sunday, May 12th of 1935, right? But our sobriety date for the fellowship is June 10th, a month later. It's actually the 17th about, but anyways, we're going to see what we have in the book, right? You know, and I don't know if there's any history drillers in here, but anyways, we use June 10th, and he didn't get sober. Now, we talk about going back to the old days. Got to be careful about that. There's no traditions in the 30s, right? There's nothing to hold us together. If you've been through a tradition series with me, you know what I'm talking about. I'll make half you people leave the room right now because you don't qualify for being in an early meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I have those traditions. I could read them. They're called bylaws at the time. And I'll make everybody get up and leave because you're not invited to this meeting. But I'm not going to do that. For the interest of unity. But I decided that I wanted to go out there. And so Dr. Bob gets sober and he says, hey, guess what? I'm in the Oxford group. I go to meetings. I go to regular meetings. I go to church. I've read the Bible and I'm praying. And this is Dr. Bob. This is Dr. Bob telling us, right? And this is conference approved stuff, right? And guess what? It's not enough to keep him sober. And what Dr. Bob, if Dr. Bob doesn't meet his sponsor, Bill, and by the way, I know it's his sponsor, just like, you know, Ebby was Bill's sponsor, and I know because Dr. Bob called Bill's sponsor, and he called him sponsor by name. And if he doesn't get to Bill and get a sponsor and get a couple other elements there, he dies drunk with a Bible on the nightstand, right? That's just AA history, right? And there's two ideas that he doesn't have, the idea of service, and he's never made amends. He's never straightened out his stuff. So he goes out on June 10th and makes his amends and comes home that night. You know, they think he's drinking, Anna's wife and Bill, right? And he says, I've been out mending fences. And he never drinks again until dying 15 years later in November of 1950, right? So I can build a case that Alcoholics Anonymous started on the backs of 8 and 9, just like the Oxford group from which we draw much of our stuff was established with that. And you would think that what it is, that what we have to give to the newcomer is to not drink, like as the most important thing. And it is the firm foundation upon which all the other steps are built, the first step, and without which it's a house of cards. But that being said, even though the big book never stops talking about alcohol, it talks about something much deeper than that. And he addressed that in an article in 1961 in the AA Grapevine in April. And it was called God as We Understand Him, The Dilemma of No Faith. And he talks about our greatest gift to the newcomer. And he says, faith is more than our greatest gift. It's sharing with others is our greatest responsibility. May we of AA continually seek the wisdom and the willingness by which we may well fulfill that immense trust which the giver of all perfect gifts has placed in our hands. It's a miracle that we have a way to assuage guilt and shame and remorse through the eighth and ninth steps and get not only whole with God and ourselves, but because of that wholeness, start to get whole in our relationships with others. You know, I have felt the thing that changed in my accident the most, I got a lot of things broken, but what changed the most is he moved me from head to heart. A lot of people know me in here. I'm just a cerebral junkie, right? And I don't, you know, my sponsor calls me the professor. It's not necessarily a compliment, you know? But what he did is he hijacked the mainframe for a period of time so that I couldn't access it and I couldn't reason myself anywhere. And I had to spend time in here, and it was where I needed to spend time. And the interesting thing about that for me is that's all about 8 and 9, about relationships, restoration of relationships, about playing nice in the sandbox, which is what AA is all about, right? And what it's done is it's gotten me not just closer to God and closer to myself, but closer to you. You know, Alcoholics Anonymous is just a bunch of drunks, but it's a bunch of drunks who show up. You know, so when I thank AA for my life, I thank people like you that just show up, you know. I hear all the time that Alcoholics Anonymous is for the quitters. It's for the quitters. Those are the people that quit. They can't do it anymore. Hey, guess what? You know, all you people in here, you people are here because you never quit. You know, everybody else says, I got to get up for work. Oh, she's going to be pissed. I got to get home. Blah, 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 blah. We don't quit for any of that. Alcoholics Anonymous is for people who never quit no matter what. It's for the lions and the lionesses. And Alcoholics Anonymous meetings like this is where the alcoholics, the lions come to cry. God bless you.